This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. You're listening to Detailing Addiction on America's Web Radio. Today in studio, I'm very happy to have Barbara A. Heath, who is the Diversion Program Manager for the southeastern area of the DEA. She has had a long and a very exciting career with the DEA, traveling across the United States as well as living in Frankfurt, Germany for a time. She oversees about 55 diversion inspectors, a number of other clerical and support staff, and she's here to talk with us today about the DEA's special take-back program that will be held this Saturday, September 27th, across the United States. And we'll give you more information if you're interested in finding out how to take your prescription drugs back and what is appropriate ways of dispensing with medication that you no longer need. Before we get started, though, I think that it would be really interesting, if you don't mind, Ms. Heath, talking about the history of the DEA. Now, I know that back in 73, by executive order, President Nixon established the DEA. But I think most of our listeners probably assume, like I did for many years, that the DEA were the folks in the windbreakers with DEA on the back, you know, raiding, well, I'm referring to Breaking Bad, let's just be honest. But I think that's what most people think, and that certainly is a big part of what the DEA does. But there's a whole lot more, and you're responsible for a very important part of that.
Yes, and I appreciate being able to make that distinction. In the DEA, there's basically the illicit drugs, which are the heroin and the cocaine and the marijuana, and then there's the non-illicit, the pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And the DEA has a special section of talented people that make sure that the drugs move through what they call a closed system of distribution. In other words, where they're manufactured, they can account for all of these pharmaceutical drugs from the time they're manufactured until they're distributed to somebody that receives a prescription at a pharmacy. So that's our position, is to make sure that the drugs stay in this closed system of distribution so that there's not a lot of extra pills on the street. And so we have that tasking to make sure the pharmaceuticals stay safe.
And I think that that is such a huge, huge, huge responsibility. And I know that all along the way, you oversee not just the manufacturing and the shipping and mm-hmm. the dispensing from pharmacies, but I personally have to register with the DEA every 3 years, renew my number. I'm sure that it's not just a matter of I pay my fee and I get my license to dispense meds, that there is checking and certifying that I'm a physician, that I'm in good standing, mm-hmm. that I haven't been arrested, that I'm not...
Excellent, yes. That's also part of the system, is the registering of doctors, pharmacists, dentists, because when you re-register, we do checks with mm-hmm. the state and local boards to make sure your licenses are still valid. We do ask on your renewal applications, have you been arrested or have you had any problems with drugs? If there is an incident, we investigate that fully to make sure mm-hmm. that you should retain that ability to have that license to dispense those drugs. So that's all part of the renewal process that we do.
So you're overseeing the prescribers, the mm-hmm. individuals who are writing the prescriptions. You're overseeing the pharmacies, like the chain pharmacies around town.
Correct.
But also pharmacies in hospitals or surgery
Absolutely.
Centers, nursing homes, different places
right.
that most of our listeners might not think about, but still fall under your area of responsibility.
Absolutely, and the section here in Atlanta has almost the second highest population of what we call DEA registrants.
Really?
In the United States. North Carolina has a huge manufacturing center
right.
of pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. but it's also, you know, there's lots and lots more doctors and pharmacies here in Georgia than there are in Idaho, for example.
Yeah.
So we have a huge population mm-hmm. basis, and that's kind of how the diverse investigators are assigned. Where are the major population centers, and how many do you need for those centers to effectively conduct those inspections?
Rick Allen, whom you mm-hmm. may know, who oversees some of the local activity through pharmacies and works with the prescription drug monitoring program here that we have in Georgia, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
He was sharing some data with me, which may have actually come out of your office. We're not talking about a few thousand prescriptions. We're talking millions of prescriptions coming out of pharmacies around this state. I was shocked at the number of prescriptions when you look at the population of some of even the smaller counties. There may be three or four prescriptions per resident in a county that may only have one or two pharmacies. It's astounding.
It is astounding. The amount of pharmaceuticals being prescribed, especially controlled substances mm-hmm. that have addictive properties,
right,
are just astounding how it has increased over the last generation. Previous generations, you didn't go to a doctor unless you were bleeding or your leg was broken, and now it seems like people go to the doctors quite often,
mm-hmm.
and this trend toward if anybody has pain, they immediately give them some sort of opiate. And then we have problems where some people, based on their chemistry, their body chemistry, become addicted quite quickly.
Yes.
And then you have other people mm-hmm. that it doesn't seem to affect. So I think I'm not a doctor, but it has something to do with how it's metabolized and mm-hmm. how it's taken into their system. And it seems some people have said, well, I went to the hospital for this and I took one pill and I became addicted. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it does seem to have a problem where some people have the tendency to become addicted easier than other people.
That's absolutely true. The genetics of the disease of addiction, I think, are becoming more and more well established. Unfortunately, we aren't born with a barcode that
right.
says, okay, you're going to be allergic to penicillin and you're going to be extra sensitive to the seasonal pollen, and you're also, by the way, genetically vulnerable for the disease of addiction.
Right.
So many people don't know that they are until they are.
Right.
So
exactly.
That whole triad that Nora Volkow from the National Institute of Drug Abuse talks about in terms of you need to have to become addicted to a drug.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that's different than dependent. People
right.
can take a medication for a long enough period of time that their body adapts, and when they stop it, they get sick.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean they have addiction, but if you have the genes for addiction,
correct,
you have an environmental stress or an opportunity, and you have the drug.
Mm-hmm.
So the person, like you were describing, they go to the hospital, they've got surgery, the doctor gives them the medication, and suddenly everything aligns the perfect storm, and they walk out of that hospital with a new problem.
A new problem.
Maybe their disease of addiction has been activated.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to tell. And our purpose is, like I said, to ensure that people are getting quality products. Number
right.
one, they're from the manufacturer. That
they're safe.
They're safe. They're effective. But we're also, part of our philosophy is to educate and make sure that people understand that just because it is USDA certified
mm-hmm.
hydrocodone doesn't mean you need to take it recreationally.
Right. Right. That's not in the
That's not in the the prescription bottle that says just
right.
When you feel like it.
That's not
take
in
it.
The indication from the Food and Drug Administration.
Exactly.
They are not saying this is intended for pain control and or recreational use. That
absolutely.
Is not on the list.
Right.
But unfortunately, we have a society that seems very open mm-hmm. to trying substances and some behaviors that may be very dangerous and potentially addictive.
Right. And then we also have the problem where we talk about where we have these take-back days is to get the word out that these medications may have been given to the mother or the father or the grandmother or grandfather that's living in the house, and that there may be some young child in the mm-hmm. house or a teenager that has heard about this and wants to experiment with this. So that's why we started these national take-backs, because we were finding a lot of the people that became experimenting with the pharmaceuticals usually got them from their own mm-hmm. parents' medicine cabinet. And so it was intended to get the word out, to educate. When you don't need this anymore, don't keep it in your medicine cabinet. If you no longer mm-hmm. have a pain, but you have a bottle sitting there, please take it somewhere and let it be disposed of.
And disposed of safely.
Correct.
So the take-back days were to educate people on the fact that for most young adolescents and young adults, their source of drugs is not the creepy guy at the end of playground who's selling drugs.
Right.
It's grandma's medicine cabinet. It's the medicine cabinet at home. It's sitting out on the counter. And this is where most people, certainly the people that I see who already have gotten into trouble because of drugs and alcohol, when we ask them where they get their drugs, that's where they started. At least when they start.
Absolutely. So the intent was to cut the starting point, if you will, to not introduce it to young people too early in life. So to advise the public, don't keep these in your medicine cabinet. Turn these in. Let us dispose of them. Let us, you know, make sure that all of these substances are rendered inert. And I think that was the whole intent, because we were seeing, you know, exponentially, you know, third and fourth graders mm-hmm. knowing what Xanax was or hydrocodone was, or, you know, we're talking about an 8 or 9 year old that knew what the difference between a Xanax and a hydrocodone when their parents and their grandparents didn't know. So that was the purpose, to start cleaning out those medicine cabinets.
Decreasing the opportunity
and risk
for kids to be able to get started with some of these substances, and to share with their friends and to create risk.
Because that's the area of peer pressure mm-hmm. at that age, where so many of them are pushed or directed towards something they probably wouldn't have done if mom and dad was there.
On their own. And so how effective have these take-back days been?
Boy, they've been tremendous. Here in the Atlanta division, on our last take-back, we got 40,000 pounds of...
Not 40,000 pills.
40,000 pounds of controlled not strictly controlled substances, but during the take-back events, we had approximately 300 law enforcement agencies registered. So in one day, from 10 o'clock to 2 p.m., we collected 40,000 pounds of drugs that needed to be destroyed.
That, I mean, when you think about that alone, it's a staggering number when you think that that was collected in a very short period of time.
4 hours.
Amazing. We'll be right back. We're going to take a commercial, and then we'll talk more with Ms. Heath from the DEA. Thanks for listening.
This is David Donaldson with the Atlanta Healing Center, conveniently located in Lawrenceville, Georgia. At AHC, your success is our goal. Addiction recovery is about more than just not using. It's about becoming a whole person and addressing all aspects of your physical, psychological, and social needs. Please call us at 770-696-9862, or you can reach us on the web at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Hello, this is Michael Daly with Atlanta Healing Center. We know that addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is a family disease. Addiction is a treatable disease. We have a caring professional staff with over 30 years experience to help you and your loved ones in your recovery. You can reach us at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Susan Blank. In studio today, I have Barbara A. Heath, who is the Diversion Program Manager for North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia. Did I get that right?
Correct.
She's in charge of monitoring regulations, overseeing, investigating, start to finish, manufacture to dispensing, and now disposing of pharmaceutical medications, not just controlled substances, but in the case of the Take Back Day, all kinds of medications, leftover antibiotics or your old antihistamine that didn't really work, or your old antidepressants. You know, these may not be controlled substances in the sense of addiction potential, but they're still dangerous. You can overdose on some of the antidepressants and people can die. So it's not just to decrease recreation, it's also just a public safety issue.
It's absolutely public safety. Anytime we can remove medication, whether it's controlled substances or just regularly prescribed medicine, from the ability to be misused, mm-hmm. then I think we've done the public some good.
Absolutely. And this has been a very effective program. You've had 9 of these.
This will be our 9th.
This will be the 9th. And I understand from the press release this is the last one.
Right.
Does that mean we've cleaned it all up?
No, it doesn't mean we've cleaned it all up. What it means is they've introduced some new regulations that become effective in October. It allows people easier methods to dispose of them. In other words, we were doing these take-backs every 6 months.
Right.
And they had to have a joint law enforcement partner. In other words, we had to have a sheriff's department or a police department host it and basically maintain security of those drugs until they could get them destroyed or give them to us for destruction. So now they have designed laws and implemented them that will allow the consumer to take their medication and more easily dispose of it. So they've allowed all of those DEA registrants we talked about previously, which are pharmacies and hospitals and any kind of distributors, and the person could take those in if they were registered with DEA as a collector, and they will have a special box, and they'll be able to put those drugs in a box, no questions asked, and those things get sealed, and then they get sent for disposal. So it's a little more easier for the public instead of waiting 6 months to get rid of the stuff and taking it to a sheriff's department. They can just go to any of the DEA registrants, which is be like CVS or Rite Aid or any of the major chain pharmacies that decide they're going to invest in this program, then they will have the opportunity to drop those expired or unused medications there and have them disposed of.
And so then law enforcement would still be involved at that point in transporting and destroying, or how will that work?
There is a form of DEA registrants called reverse distributors, and they're distributors that basically take all of the controlled substance back for destruction. So usually they're incinerators. And what happens is the pharmacy or the hospital or whoever will become a collector, but then they'll ensure that that bag is sealed, it's numbered, et cetera, and then it's sent over for destruction to one of those incinerators, basically. So it's a program that can be done locally, more local impact. The law enforcement community can still do take back, but they're going to have to create and craft their own ways for the destruction portion of the pharmaceuticals.
So if I went home or if I'm driving home and I'm listening to this show, and I decide, wow, I really probably ought to clean out my
medicine cabinet.
Do I open up all the containers and dump the bags into a shopping
mm-hmm. bag and take it back? Do I leave it in the bottle? How would it be best for me to do that?
We don't have any restrictions on how you deliver them to us. Some people bring them in the bottles. some people feel it necessary to take their name and mark off their name and what the drug is, or because for privacy purposes, that's not a problem. Some people don't want to take the bottles. They just want to pour it in a bag and hand the law enforcement officer a bag, and that's fine, too. Whatever the individual person wants. We don't have to know what's in the bag, essentially. You hand us the bag, we put it in another sealed bag, and then it's destroyed.
And then it's destroyed. Which brings me to another topic. Back when I was in the ancient of days, when I was in medical school, I remember that they used to tell me, when you have extra medicine, mm-hmm. if the patient brings in their medicine, we're just going to flush it down the toilet, or we're going to pour it down the sink,
right.
or I'm in surgery and we haven't used all of the anesthetics, so two of us will go to the sink and we'll just flush
Waste
it down
it.
The sink.
Right.
So why shouldn't people just go home and open the bottles and dump it down the
Well, I think we've all become a little more conscious of the environment since that time. So we found through our uses that we like to use incineration because it completely destroys the substance. But there's nothing wrong with taking a small amount of the medicine and rendering it useless. A lot of people, you know, there are, under the FDA at their website, there are guidelines
right.
on how to dispose small amounts of, medicines at home. I think some of them suggest cat litter and coffee grounds and kind of make it a soupy mess so nobody can dig in your trash can and get your pills. But in generally, when we bring large amounts of pills, mm-hmm. we don't want to put it in the watershed. We don't.
Right.
We don't want to dump it in landfills. We'd like to dispose of it. And usually, most of the DEA registrants use those reverse distributors that usually use incineration.
And I think that's so important. I was at a prescription drug prevention collaborative that we have here in the state of Georgia, and there was a young lady from the Georgia Conservancy mm-hmm. Partnering, and I thought, well, this is very interesting. Mm-hmm. She's wanting to partner with us in preventing prescription mm-hmm. drug abuse. Why? And then she proceeded to talk about some of the research that's been done in the state of Tennessee looking at the amounts of prescription drugs that are measurable mm-hmm. in the water.
In the water, absolutely.
And the effects of these drugs on some of the wildlife, mm-hmm. the fish, mm-hmm. the mollusks.
Absolutely.
Animals that live in the water, and then we began to think, oh, we're drinking the water.
Right.
And normal filtration systems may not be small enough to really clean out these prescription drugs. And it's fine if I need to be on estrogen because I'm in menopause, but probably some of the other folks in this room wouldn't want to be getting a regular dose of estrogen.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really important that people understand that, no, we don't want you just throwing your pills out in the trash
right.
in your container. We don't want you hoarding them and keeping them for years after they've already expired and you're no longer using them. We don't want them to become tempting to young people who are experimenting. We want them disposed of safely, appropriately, and where they're not going to get in the hands of people who don't need to be.
Absolutely. We have tons of interest from clean water conservative groups mm-hmm. and those types of things that say, what law enforcement agency can I contact to get on board? So we've been doing that since Take Back One, mm-hmm. is connecting those groups so that they can be involved in putting the word out.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put this in the watershed. Don't put this in the landfill. Bring it to the law enforcement entity and let them dispose of it. So we've been doing that since the beginning of this Take Back operation.
So this coming Saturday, mm-hmm. September 27th, I believe.
Correct.
Will be a Take Back Day. And this is an opportunity for you to really do your fall cleaning and clean out all those cabinets and cupboards. How would someone know where to take the medications now?
Well, what we do is all of the law enforcement entities that participate in those four states that we talked about, they register with us, and then I have my people go in to a central website, and they register them online. So if you go to DEA.gov.
DEA.gov.
Right. There will be a big banner with the pills about the take back, and you can click on that, and then it will further take you, and you can streamline to a specific zip code. And then you can put your zip code in, and it will tell you within 10 miles or 50 miles or 5 miles where the nearest take-back location is going to be. And it will specifically say, well, it's going to be on Roswell Road, you know, at this location. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have a great idea. You can just look it up, put your zip code in. It'll tell you the closest locations, and you can usually – it's usually a drive-by event. Mm-hmm. We have law enforcement officers that stand outside usually and – with a big box, and they take your bag and put it in a box, and the box gets sealed, and then we go around and pick it up and destroy it.
So people aren't going to have to show their driver's license or reveal what medicine it is or where they got it. Or
absolutely not.
Who prescribed it? It's anonymous, easy, fast,
absolutely,
and safe,
absolutely
safe for the community and the environment, which I think is really important.
We have a lot of the local law enforcement communities really tied in with not only the take back with the pharmaceuticals, but they do the recycling at the same time. They'll have the same, you know, turn in your old batteries, turn in your old electronics that are not working. So basically check with your local county in your area, with your state area, and then also you can find out, you know, they may be taking three or four lines of things. They may be taking pharmaceuticals in one area, and then electronics that also are not good, you know.
Right. You don't want those old batteries and some of the components of old computers and old televisions and things like that can be very toxic to the environment.
So truly a good day to clean out.
A good day to clean out everything, get ready for the holidays. You've
Absolutely.
Got plenty of space to hide all those holiday gifts. So DEA.gov, and then you can click on the banner.
All right.
Find your enter your zip code, and then find your local place to dispense of your old medication.
Absolutely.
How long before we'll see these take-back bins or these disposal bins at pharmacies or hospitals?
Well, it's a voluntary thing, so those people have to decide if they're going to participate and if they want to put those collection bins out in their locations. They have to go into DEA at a registration and basically check a box that says, I'm going to be a collector, and then they have to follow the rules from there. Law enforcement, I think there's a huge initiative throughout the state of Georgia and many other states where they have in their lobbies placed old mailboxes, if you want to call them that, post office boxes, and usually they'll have some sort of drop box in their lobbies where, again, you come in anonymously, you take the pills, you put it in the old mailbox and walk away, and nobody asks you any questions. So law enforcement continue to anonymously collect these, you know, drugs.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit more about safe storage and some of the other options around safe care and disposal of your prescription meds. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Michael Daly with Atlanta Healing Center. We know that addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is a family disease. Addiction is a treatable disease. We have a caring professional staff with over 30 years experience to help you and your loved ones in your recovery. You can reach us at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock for Medicine on Call. On Medicine on Call, we talk about more than medicine. It's about how to take control of your mind, body, and spirit.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
Hi, I'm Paisley McDonald, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, At Home with Paisley, every week, Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, for practical advice and stylish living for your home and office.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Susan Blank. Today we're talking with Diversion Program Manager Barbara A. Heath from the Drug Enforcement Agency. She oversees diversion activities throughout North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia. We've been talking about the ninth and final DEA-sponsored Drug Take-Back Day, which will be this Saturday, September 27th. And again, please check your medicine cabinets and then check the website DEA.gov and find your local center, because I think it really is important. And I know that there have been times in my career that patients have brought me their stash, or patients have said, my grandmother died and I've got bottles of stuff, and legally I'm not allowed to take that back. Right. And they said, I've had several people say, I've tried taking it to the pharmacy. They won't take it back. What am I supposed to do? So I'm so glad that you all have started this program and that you've established these sites. I think in Georgia, every county has a take-back site at one of the local law enforcement agencies. That's open as long as the agency is open. But I think these national take-back days have been really important for people to think about it and do it. But it's safe, right?
They're
not going to be followed or judged.
We don't have the personnel or the manpower to do that, considering, like I said, the amount of things that are dropped off. And for safety reasons, I ensure that my people, you know, do not open bags, because we put out that we don't want to accept needles or syringes or
right.
anything like that, but we still get them.
I'm sure.
So basically, all I want my people to do is take whatever's given to them and put it in a nice, safe cardboard box so that we can tape it up and take it to a incinerator, basically. So we don't want to subject our people either.
Right. You don't want them
We're not going to go dig in the garbage for...
Good. I just think it's important for families
sure.
and for individuals to understand that this is a safe, sane process and one that they should really consider. And while hospitals and pharmacies are going to be allowed to do this, that may take some time. And not everybody's going to have the manpower or the ability. So do it now. Don't wait and hope that
it's going to be 2 months down the road I can just take it to a pharmacy. But
right.
the pharmacy may decide it's too cumbersome for them to do that. So it's their choice. We can't force them to
sure.
do that. But a lot of people have indicated that through their goodwill that they would like to do that and help taking those drugs off the street. So that's just another avenue now that we can use. Because the rules were written back in 1973, we never thought about what do we do with the pills when they don't take them. When you take two or three pills and you're done with them and you don't mm-hmm. need them anymore, we never thought about the residual pills that were left over and how to dispose of them. So now the rules have been amended, and now we're giving mm-hmm. more opportunity for more people to accept these drugs and get them disposed of correctly.
I think that's a very good idea. And there are going to be listeners out there who are thinking, well, but I'm still taking them. I'm mm-hmm. still taking a controlled substance. I've got this disorder or that problem. And these medications, I get my medicine bottle and it's got all these warnings on it. How do you recommend that people safely store their medicines at home that they are going to have to take?
Well, I think each individual has to look at their you know, individual situation. If there's no young children around, I think, you know, there's different, you can have less restrictive areas. So if you do have children in the house or teenagers in the house, you might want to put it in some lockable container to prevent, you know, mixing it up with something else or having it, you know, confused with, you know, an antibiotic or something that actually may be very harmful. So we do stress that just don't leave the medicines around. Don't leave them on your nightstand. Don't leave them on, you know, on the TV,
right.
Next to the TV.
On your kitchen table.
Right, on your kitchen table. You know, do diligence, as we call it, and keep those out of sight and take them when you need them. But, you know, obviously protect the other people in the house that might not know what they are.
And just because I've had some of my patients tell me how they've gotten their meds, mm-hmm. I do want to stress that things like parties,
mm-hmm.
garage sales,
mm-hmm.
open house because you're selling your house, times when there are going to be people coming through your home that you may not really know much about. I've
Absolutely.
Had several patients tell me they used to schedule to go and tour a really nice house and then need to use the bathroom.
Absolutely.
And go in and raid the medicine cabinets.
There are all kinds of sneaky and suspicious ways that people can do that, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
We had reports at one point in time where people were watching obituaries, and if mm-hmm. the person had had a long extended illness, and it said that in the obituary, they would wait for the funeral date and then mm-hmm. go to the location of the home while everybody was grieving and ransack the house for drugs. It's an addiction. And it's,
right, and people
and
do things that in their right
mind they would not do. But that's the extent that some people, when they crave that, mm-hmm. they will go to do it. So you have to use very much careful thought when you have these drugs around because they are something that people will crave and do things for.
So. Exactly. Another thought is that many people keep their medications, their prescription medications, in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. You brush your teeth, you take your medicine, you mm-hmm. get ready and go for the day. But humidity, mm-hmm. a lot of steam, can actually affect some of the medicines, can change their potency, can mm-hmm. make them more or less effective. So that's probably not a really
good place.
Unless your medicine cabinet is separate from your shower
and, area.
Your tub. So think about a safe, reasonable place that's not going to be too completely obvious, especially if you're not locking them, but make sure that
right.
they're safe because people die from this disease, and unfortunately far too many of our young people are getting started on prescription drugs. You know, some recent studies from, I think it was the National Household Survey, showing that the drug of first initiation,
mm-hmm.
The illicit drug, not tobacco or alcohol, but the first illicit drug for most people was marijuana.
Absolutely.
Around 50%, a mm-hmm. little bit more. What was really surprising to me as I'm looking at these statistics is that 22%, their first illicit drug or their first use of a medication for non-medical reasons was an opiate, a pain reliever. This is really much more common than I think many people understand.
Absolutely. And I think people have to become, like I said, educated that these teenagers, sometimes they have what they call farm parties. Well, each teenager has to bring something from their parents' medicine
mm-hmm.
cabinet, and they don't know if it's, you know, an amphetamine or a barbiturate or an opiate, or they'll mix them all together in a big bowl and take a handful and hopefully wake up the next morning.
Right. Hopefully no one dies.
Right. But it's just troubling that we're not getting the message out
mm-hmm.
and the parents are not listening enough to know that, okay, I don't need to leave any of my medication around.
Right. Any. Because kids are smart. They've got their smartphones. They've got Hippocrates or WebMD, and they can look up the size and shape and color of the pill.
And know exactly what they have.
So they're probably a lot smarter than at least I am. And they have, they're looking very specifically often for some drugs, but other more naive kids will think, well, I don't know what this is. I'm just...
Right. Or it's, you know, here, Joey, try this.
Try this. And, and they do. So... It is very important to safely dispose of, responsibly take, and make sure that you're taking care of your meds.
Absolutely.
I'm so glad you're here today because I think very shortly we're going to have a lot of people, some doctors, and a lot of frustrated pharmacists with the change in the scheduling of hydrocodone.
Okay.
So maybe you could explain a little bit about what scheduling is.
Sure.
And then what this change is going to mean for people.
Okay. The DEA defines controlled substances into five categories. Category one is a category of what we call the illicit drugs. They have, quote-unquote, no medical use. In other words, there's no medical use for heroin. So those are the types of drugs that are the on the illicit side. Then we get to the pharmaceutical side, and we schedule them from schedule 2 through 5, 2 being the most potent and 5 being the less potent. And that's been because it goes through all kinds of testing with FDA and DEA, and they decide, okay, it has a more high propensity for addiction,
right,
which are opiates usually, and then maybe something on the low level, maybe a diluted cough syrup that doesn't have a lot of codeine in it, maybe a Schedule 5. So we have Schedules 2 through 5 that we look at in the pharmaceutical, 2 being the most restricted controlled substance that you can get from a doctor or a hospital. Hydrocodone had previously been a Schedule 3 since it came on the market or when we were established, and it has been for many, many years. But because we have seen this huge trend in the U.S. population, there were requests that the hydrocodone be rescheduled or moved up into the higher level of a Schedule 2. The difference between a Schedule 2 to a 3 between a normal person is they really don't understand
they don't
it.
Know, right.
And they don't know. The difference between a Schedule 2 and a 3 to a doctor, they truly understand the difference because of the rules and the stricter restrictions that we place on those. A Schedule 2 prescription normally can be called in to a pharmacy. A Schedule 3 prescription can be called into a pharmacy. A Schedule 2 prescription must be on a written piece of paper, and it must be handed to that pharmacist.
And signed by the doctor.
And signed by the doctor. And it's a little more control factor, if you will. It's not as easy as you go into the doctor's office and they just hit a button and it's automatically transferred to the pharmacy and you zip around the corner and pick up your stuff and go home. Schedule 2, there's actually a paper prescription required. And there's some different rules and regulations as to there's not specifically refills for Schedule 2s. Where Schedule 3 through 5s, you can have up to 5 refills without having to go back to the doctor. So there are some major differences between Schedule 3 through 5s and the Schedule 2s.
I know as a physician, if I'm writing a Schedule 2 medication, and sometimes I have to do that, I have to have specific type of paper. In my office, I use carbons so that I've got also in my chart a copy of what I actually wrote. I think most doctors take care to write out the numerals, write
correct
number 10, and then write T-E-N.
Absolutely.
Write no refills. There's a number of ways that I think physicians have been trained, nurse practitioners as well, trained to be very careful about how they write prescriptions. We're going to take a break now. We're going to talk about why this rescheduling of hydrocodone might complicate life for some of you listeners. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Michael Daly with Atlanta Healing Center. We know that addiction is a brain disease. Addiction is a family disease. Addiction is a treatable disease. We have a caring professional staff with over 30 years experience to help you and your loved ones in your recovery. You can reach us at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. You're listening to Detailing Addiction, and today we're talking with Barbara A. Heath, who is the Diversion Program Manager for the states of North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia. We've been talking about a number of interesting subjects. The DEA has been very busy here over the last few months, and we've talked about the National Take Back Day, and again, encourage everyone to clean up, clean out, and safely dispose of your medications. And you can go to DEA.gov for more information about sites for this Saturday and further information about safe storage and disposal. We've also been talking about the rescheduling, moving hydrocodone, which is brand names might be Lortab, Vicodin. These are medications that are commonly prescribed for pain. Usually, primary care doctors go to the dentist. You've got a tooth extraction. You sprain your ankle. Primary care, emergency rooms. A lot of doctors may prescribe these medications. And so when we talk about it now becoming a more restrictive medication that is going to require have additional requirements, this may complicate things.
It may. It will take a I think a period of transition before all the physicians become
aware,
not only aware, but basically, okay, I have to stop and now write a prescription instead of just faxing or emailing or telling somebody to fax or email.
Right, or calling it in.
So there's a couple more steps required. As we talked earlier, a Schedule 3 could have 5 refills. A Schedule 2 cannot. But it does give the physician an opportunity to give up to 90 days worth of medication. Generally, they would write a prescription for the first 30 days, and then they would write a second prescription for the next 30 days, and then the final 90 days. So those prescriptions could stay on file at the pharmacy. So when your first prescription is up and it's time for renewal, you don't have to go back to the doctor again for another doctor visit. They would pull that second script out and then final that third script. So it's generally a 90-day time frame. Pretty much requires that the doctor see you, evaluate you, and determine that you really do need this to stay on this pain medication instead of, you know,
just making an assumption.
Maybe your sprained ankle is healed and you don't need it anymore. So it's making the doctors aware that they need to monitor those pain medicines.
And I think one of the things that the Medical Association of Georgia Foundation, SAMHSA, a number of national and local organizations are working on educating doctors about prescribing, particularly the long-acting opiate pain relievers, but also more practical pointers around the shorter acting like the hydrocodone. So doctors are getting educated because we are seeing this tremendous increase in prescriptions for opioids. pain relievers, and we're seeing vast increases in the number of folks who are active in the disease of addiction. So this is a big problem. And in talking with pain management physicians, who I think for the most part are some of the most educated in terms of proper prescribing, you know, they're becoming more and more aware of them, and the literature is becoming really clear that the opioids, the synthetics or the natural ones, are very good for acute pain. If I have to have my appendix out, boy, I sure hope my doctor will help me out with my pain control. But that they're not really as helpful as we had initially thought, and they're certainly not as safe as we had initially hoped in long-term chronic pain. And so many doctors are rethinking, and I think the DEA stepping in and helping that process in terms of let's help doctors really evaluate, is this person still having sufficient pain that they need this medicine? And how is their function?
Right.
Are they functioning better? Oh, I can get most people out of pain, but they may be sitting drooling in their corner.
Absolutely.
Is their function better? Are
right.
they able to do more? Then that's appropriate use of,
sure.
of pain medicine. So from an addiction medicine standpoint, we very much applaud the DEA in doing this. But I know there's going to be some unhappy people and some confused people when they think that they can go back to the pharmacy and get prescription number 4, 5, or 6.
Refilled, right.
And the pharmacist is going to have to say,
I'm sorry, you have to go back and bring me a prescription. Right. There will be a transition period. I think it's written into the rules. Generally, a prescription that's on file that has refills will continue to be refilled for a period of time. So I think there's like a 6-month transition period for those prescriptions to run out and then for the new rules basically to go into effect. There will be a lot of phone calls from a lot of pharmacists and a lot of doctors. We've already started to receive them.
I'm sure.
But as you pointed out, from your expertise in the treatment of addiction, these opioids have led to a huge resurgence in heroin addiction.
Yes.
Talk about people dying and when they started, they'll say, I started with opioids, and that led me to heroin.
Right.
And usually it's economic because a pill on the street that has 30 milligrams of codeine may cost $30.
Right.
But a hit of heroin will cost $5. So economically, your body becomes dependent. Mm-hmm. The addiction grows. You need more. Economically, you can't afford that $30 pill anymore. Now you have to go to the street and take something off the street that is not FDA approved.
Right. Or controlled.
So we've seen a lot of counterclockwise movement. Initially, 30 years ago, we saw a lot of heroin addicts, and they only went to opioids when they couldn't get heroin off the street. And now we see the reverse trend of, no, that people only use opioids until they can't get them anymore or afford them anymore, and then they go to the heroin cycle. So it's a reverse cycle that we've seen over the last 30 years. And so the tightening of these restrictions on opioid medication, I think, is a way to get doctors to really examine and know, yes, I want to issue that prescription. I want to be sure this person needs that pain medicine.
I think that combined with here in the state of Georgia, the Physician Practice Act that now is saying, and it's important for our listeners to understand that if a doctor is going to choose to put you on long-term pain medicine for more than 90 days, you're going to have to do some drug tests.
Right.
And that's not the doctor being mean or suspicious. That's the doctor complying with the law.
Correct.
That we need to make sure that you're taking the medicines that you're prescribed in the way that you're prescribed and not using other medicines that might not mix well.
Right.
So there are some real important changes that I think may be surprising and maybe even offend a few of our listeners.
Patients.
Right, the patients. But,
absolutely.
But there's some reasons behind it.
I think there's some goals and some reasons behind it. I don't think anybody's trying to be too intrusive into your individual needs. The doctor is the expert, and the
right.
doctor will determine what you need. But the doctor will have serious discussions with
mm-hmm.
you to ensure that this is the most appropriate method. DA is not, we're not doctors, and we're not in the business of determining, okay, well, you only need 10 pills or you only need 20 pills. That is your profession and
mm-hmm.
your expertise, and we just hope to provide the additional support of saying, okay, it's time to be a little more restrictive, but it's also time to make sure that the physician understands these may develop into other problems if
right.
we don't do something now.
And to be aware of that and to be monitoring, and not that patients don't deserve good pain relief. Of course they do.
Absolutely.
But a responsible pain relief in a way that's not going to create another problem.
Exactly.
At the break and in our last couple of minutes, diversion.
Diversion.
I know what that means. Would you please let our listeners
sure.
know what we're meaning in terms of you're in charge of the diversion program?
Yeah. It has a lot of connotations in a different situation. Some people think when it comes to law enforcement, it means if I go into a diversion program, then it's not going to be on my record if I complete this program.
Right.
In our world, diversion means that there is some sort of to intend to manipulate the pills out of the licit market into the illicit market.
System within
Absolutely.
The law by licensed professionals to patients who truly need it.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being
Thank
with
you for
us
having
today.
Me. It's been exciting.
And if you have more questions about the work of the DEA, please go to DEA.gov. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.